Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the long-term effects of wrongful conviction and exoneration for the innocent person sent to prison and for the victim of the original crime. We'll spend this hour with law professor Laura Bazelon, who says a disorienting shift happens when an unjust conviction comes to light. The person treated as a perpetrator is suddenly a victim of an imperfect justice system, and the victim of the original crime has to wrestle with their role in getting the wrong person punished. We'll talk with Bazelon about how restorative justice programs are helping people on both sides of this strange dynamic to move past their traumas. Our conversation starts after a short break. Give you two nightmare scenarios here. First, imagine being arrested, tried, convicted, and thrown in prison for a crime you had nothing to do with. The best you could hope for would be exoneration, although nothing could restore the years of your life sacrificed to a terrible mistake. Now imagine being the victim of a crime that got somebody else wrongfully convicted. Your sense of justice would evaporate, replaced by the haunting realization that you played a role in a horrific miscarriage of justice. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It's not surprising that most of us think of exonerations as happily ever after stories. Those directly affected, though, typically live a far more complicated reality. Surely society has an obligation to help them recover, and one path to healing to such healing is something called restorative justice. Laura Bazelon is associate professor and director of the Criminal Juvenile Justice and Racial Justice Clinics at the University of San Francisco School of Law. She's author of the book Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. She joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco, and our conversation today is part of the KERA series, One Crisis Away. Way, the price of prison. Laura, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
So the recognition of wrongful conviction is supposed to fix an injustice, and it does to an extent. But, you know, you remind us it creates a surprising amount of upheaval at the same time.
Exactly. We want to believe that after the mistake has been unearthed and corrected, everyone moves on in this kind of happily ever after scenario. And it's just not the case. There's so much damage and suffering, as you point out, on both sides, from the person who's been locked away for so long, having to readjust to society and deal with a vortex of emotion, to the crime victim who may have unwittingly participated, but in any event, was told a story about the criminal justice system and about their case that was a false story.
You got interested in this because you had a client exonerated after 34 years in prison.
Yes. I had a case where my client, who very improbably is named Cash Register, was convicted of killing a man in a robbery in 1979. Cash was 18 years old. Cash is African American. He was convicted by an all-white jury after the police hid evidence and prosecutors also hid evidence and two eyewitnesses lied. And as a result of that, he went away for 34 years.
So you believed him, but you weren't positive he would get justice.
That's true. The case really took over my life in the 18 months that we litigated it. It was basically what I thought about before I went to bed. It was the first thing I thought about when I woke up. And for all that time, I really lived in fear that we would not be able to prove his innocence.
How challenging is it to find statistics about how often wrongful convictions occur?
It's very challenging. So the best information that we do have is a study from the University of Michigan that was done by Professor Samuel Gross. He looked at death penalty cases and found through a rigorous empirical analysis that about 4.1% of people on death row are actually innocent,
wow,
which is just a staggering, staggering percentage when you think about the fact that we can and do execute innocent people. So if you extrapolate that number to the general population, you end up with something like 62,000 people.
Before we move deeper into this, we should get, I guess, to the most basic question, which is, how does it happen that people are so often wrongfully convicted in a system designed around a standard of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt?
It's a great question, and there are a number of factors. One factor, unfortunately, is police and prosecutorial misconduct, which is what happened in Cash's case, as I spoke of, where essentially the desire to win at all costs overcomes the obligation to follow the rules. And so police and prosecutors may withhold evidence. They may coax confessions out of people who are not actually guilty of what they're confessing to and do other things like that. There's also the problem of faulty eyewitness identification, where a witness really truly believes that they are pointing to the guilty person, but they are in fact mistaken. And many of these situations arise when the victim is one race and the accused is a different race.
Is there a reason why these cross-racial identifications are the least reliable?
Well, there is a lot of research really dating back to the 60s and the 70s that talks about how we are very bad at identifying people outside of our own racial group. There are different theories as to why that is. One popular theory is that because we live pretty segregated lives, we're not used to seeing people of different races on a regular basis in the same way that we are used to seeing people of our own race.
Hmm. What does the rate of wrongful conviction suggest about the need to preserve evidence in criminal cases even after a conviction has been reached?
It suggests that it's absolutely imperative to do that. And in so many of these cases, and what's really frustrating, innocence lawyers will tell you this, is that they have clients that they truly believe are innocent, but they can't prove it. And part of the problem is that the physical evidence has been destroyed.
And you have to be sympathetic from the perspective of law enforcement agencies. I mean, there's a cost associated with keeping all this stuff indefinitely.
That is true. I think you have to weigh, though, that cost against the real possibility that the system made a mistake, and that if that does happen, there's a real need to find the evidence to correct it.
Lots of people have a hard time believing that anyone would admit to a crime they didn't actually commit. What can you tell us about how and why this happens?
People do have difficulty understanding it. And I think what's so powerful about confessions, particularly to really heinous crimes, is that jurors or regular citizens hearing about them think no one would possibly admit to this unless they actually did it. But what happens in these interrogations, and I think we really saw it for folks who watched Making a Murderer with Brendan Dassey, is that the police have all kinds of psychological tactics to, as Brendan says, get in the person's head and suggest things to them and feed them information, and in some cases actually convince them that somehow they may have been responsible. The other thing that happens is that there are certain people who are particularly vulnerable. So, for example, juveniles, people with developmental delays, people who are put in real physical fear. All of those people are particularly likely to sign a confession or state that they did something when they actually didn't. And I've had clients who are young tell me, I told them what they wanted to hear because they told me that I could go home. Hmm. And you're listening to this thinking, how could you possibly believe they would let you out? But for a 16 or 17 year old, they are thinking, if I just tell them what they want to hear, I can leave.
And we should be clear, police are not prohibited from lying during these interrogations.
That is true. They can use deceptive techniques. So they can say to someone, we've tested the evidence and we found your DNA, or we talked to this person and they told us that you confessed. And none of those things could be true, but it's perfectly legal.
Why do so many defendants go to trial without competent attorneys to defend them?
So we have a real problem with indigent defense in this country, and actually that is another cause of wrongful convictions, which is bad lawyers. You get what you pay for, and in many states, indigent defense lawyers are paid so horribly that the people who end up taking these jobs are not particularly good at them. Now, I will say there are some public defender offices, I worked for one, that are incredibly well-funded and have amazing, bright, smart, energetic people working there. And then there are other offices that are underfunded. And even with people who go into it with their heart in the right place, they get completely overwhelmed and they end up almost as part of a processing factory where they're just processing people through the system. They don't have time to really spend with their clients or investigate the case. They end up getting people to plead guilty who really shouldn't. And unfortunately, because we don't value indigent defense in many parts of this country, it continues to be a substantial problem.
Well, I know you've heard the arguments against fully funding indigent defense. People say, well, if I haven't committed a crime, I'm never going to need this, and I don't want to spend a lot of money defending people who might in fact be guilty.
Right. You do hear that argument. The thing is, it's really against our fundamental constitutional values, because what we believe in this country is that regardless of what you're accused are or of what the proof is, we put the prosecution to their burden. And we say in this country, we don't strip someone of their freedom unless the prosecution has brought evidence to convince a juror beyond a reasonable doubt or to convince the accused person that it is in their best interest to plead guilty because they are in fact guilty. That's a fundamental principle. And if we take that away, we are really weakening democracy. And I will say to people who believe that the criminal justice system will never touch them, that's something that you can't really know. And it may end up touching you or someone close to you. And if it does, you would certainly want the best possible representation for that person. And you would certainly want to know before they were sent away that the state had done its job ethically and provided the right amount of proof and that that proof had been tested.
Give us a little of the history of how justice advocates in the United States started to turn their attention to the problem of wrongful conviction.
This is really the brainchild of Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld. They started out as public defenders. Barry Scheck, of course, became famous as part of O.J. Simpson's dream defense team. They both got really interested in DNA, which before they got interested in it had mainly been used to secure guilty verdicts, but it occurred to them that could also be used to exonerate people who had been convicted. They started a movement that is now known as the Innocence Movement, and they co-founded the Innocence Project. They were able to secure exoneration after exoneration into the hundreds, and through that work, they really raised national awareness that this was a significant problem.
And Texas was an early leader among states in seeking justice for the wrongfully convicted.
This is one of the most surprising things I found in the book. Texas really is at the forefront of so many important wrongful conviction-related reforms. So on the one hand, Texas executes more people than any other state in the country and has many tough-on-crime laws. On the other hand, perhaps because of the headlines of exonerations, Texas has passed a series of laws that are quite progressive. So for example, when someone has been wrongfully convicted in Texas, they get more money than any other exoneree in any other state, $80,000. They also get an annuity and the possibility of college tuition. Texas is also on the forefront of undermining, exposing junk science. So they have a forensics commission that is really the gold standard in terms of vetting certain kinds of science that later turns out to be faulty or even completely unreliable.
Oh, let's talk about some of that faulty science. I think things that if I were sitting as a member of a jury, I would assume were probably accurate are not. Things like bite mark analysis and hair analysis.
Yes. So there is a person I feature in the book named Thomas Webb, and he was convicted of raping a white woman in Oklahoma in the 1980s. And she did identify him as the person who raped her. This is a cross-racial identification. But in addition to that, the jury was told that hairs at the scene were a match to Thomas Webb. And that evidence was presented to the jury as really strong evidence that he was the perpetrator. And it kind of mutually reinforced this identification. We learned in 2015 that this so-called hair science is not science at all. And that in fact, it has no scientific foundation to the point where the FBI has re-examined all of its cases and conceded that in, I think, 97% of them, the FBI expert either misstated or grossly overstated the match and the significance. And that doesn't even begin to get to all the cases like Thomas Webb's, where you had somebody doing that on the state level as well.
So in other words, you can't take a piece of hair and say this definitely belongs to this individual.
You can't unless there's actually a follicle attached from which you can withdraw DNA. Hmm. This idea that a hair from my head could perfectly match a hair found at a crime scene, just a stray hair, has been completely debunked.
My guest is Laura Bazelon. She's associate professor and director of the Criminal Juvenile Justice and Racial Justice Clinics at the University of San Francisco School of Law. Her book is called Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. You can be part of our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. The This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Laura Bazelon, who is Associate Professor and Director of the Criminal Juvenile Justice and Racial Justice Clinics at the University of San Francisco School of Law. Her book is called Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372, or you can find us on Twitter at KERATHINK. Laura, why do some states resist exonerations despite new evidence of defendants' innocence?
It's really hard to understand because it seems counterintuitive. But what happens in a lot of states is that even when the prosecution is confronted with significant or even overwhelming evidence that the wrong person was convicted, they respond by fighting tooth and nail and coming up with alternative explanations for what could have happened that make no sense. So to give you an example, I'm from Philadelphia, and there was a pretty famous case in Philadelphia involving a man named Anthony Wright, who was convicted in the early 1990s of raping and murdering an elderly woman, and he was sent to prison. 25 years later, DNA testing from the victim matched to a deceased crack addict named Ronnie Byrd, who had no known connection to Tony Wright. The reaction from the Philadelphia district attorney was to agree that Tony was entitled to a new trial, but then they actually retried him 25 years later under a different theory. So they told the jury in 2016 that he and Ronnie Byrd acted in concert and that while Tony was not the rapist, he was the person who had fatally stabbed the victim. The jury was out for 5 minutes, and when they came back, they acquitted on all charges. The four women told the media, "I am angry they brought this case."
Wow. How long do wrongfully convicted people typically spend behind bars before they're exonerated, if they're exonerated?
The average is something like 9 years, but it really varies. So again, my client Cash, 34 years. I recently met a man named Richard Phillips, who was incarcerated wrongfully for 47 years, which is just staggering. The other thing that is concerning about the data is that it shows that if you are African American, your chances of remaining in prison longer are much higher if you have been wrongfully convicted.
It's really hard to imagine losing 34 years of one. I mean, 34 years ago, I was in high school, just starting high school. A lot's happened between then and now. How does anybody begin life over again after so much time?
That was the question that I asked myself when Cash got out. And my real fear was that he would not be able to survive. And exactly what you just said, what was going through my mind was that when he was sent away in 1979, I was in kindergarten. When he was exonerated, I had grown up and become his lawyer, and my son was in kindergarten. So that's an entire generation. And it frightened me to think that he was being thrust out into this world in a way kind of reborn. You're naked and defenseless, except that you're an adult, and so you don't get the protections that we extend to newly born infants. And it frightened me to think what would happen. And that's how I got really interested in writing this book and looking into this whole idea of restorative justice and seeing how exonerees and crime victims who had really been failed by the criminal justice system were reaching towards an alternative version of finding their own justice as a way of making sense of what had happened to them and building these kinds of alliances that were very personally rewarding but also helped them move forward.
So you remind us in this book that versions of restorative justice have existed for centuries. Can you talk about some early iterations of this?
Yeah. So Native Americans practiced restorative justice on our soil. And the concept is that when there is a harm and someone who inflicts the harm and then someone who suffers the harm, the person who is the harmer, the offender, isn't banished forever. And of course, in our culture, often that's the thinking, is that we stigmatize that person, we lock them away. And as it was practiced by Native Americans, the idea was that there was a victim-offender dialogue so that the community engaged with both parties. And you can do this in a circle where you bring together the person who has committed the offense, the person who has been the victim of the offense. And the questions that are posed are, what harm was done? What are the needs of the victim? And whose obligation is it to meet those needs? It's a very case-specific process where the two people directly involved and their families and community members engage with each other, talk through the harm, tell their individual stories, and then decide together what they're going to do to make reparations and to re-knit their community.
So this can be a really jarring reversal for people who were victims of an actual crime that took place, but had a role, perhaps an accidental or inadvertent role, in sending the wrong person to prison for that crime.
Yes, and people who practice restorative justice were somewhat skeptical of the idea that you could apply it in cases of wrongful conviction, because in a way, you're talking about everyone being a victim, and there is no true perpetrator, or the true perpetrator is someone who ultimately was caught and incarcerated, but not part of this process. The thing that's interesting, though, is what you have in a wrongful conviction is someone who has been branded a perpetrator, like my client Cash, been branded a murderer and sent away. And then you have victims, for example, like the victim in the case of Thomas Webb, who was a rape victim, who truly was victimized in the worst possible way and feared for her life. Well, in the case of the person who was branded the perpetrator, it is revealed that they were the victim. And then for the victim, it is revealed that they participated, however unwittingly, in a process that led to this miscarriage of justice. And so they feel like a perpetrator. And they are the only two people in the world who can truly understand the case from a 360-degree perspective.
There's also the reality that whoever committed the actual crime may not be behind bars.
That's right. And actually, one of the hardest things about some of these cases is that the real perpetrator is never caught, or is caught too late in the sense that the statute of limitations may have run, or too late in the sense that they went on to victimize other people.
Are there best practices for informing victims of the original crime that a wrongful conviction took place in their case?
Yes, and they are not followed in many, many cases. And one thing that was interesting to me in researching this book is that I spent a lot of time with a victim, and I'm using her full name because she's public, named Janet Burke. And she was the victim of a terrifying rape when she was 20 years old in the 1980s. And she did make a misidentification, and that led to the incarceration of the wrong person. And she describes the way that she was told that a mistake had happened 26 years later, which is that detectives showed up at her house unannounced, and her two children didn't even know that she had been a victim of sexual assault. So she had to hustle them off into their rooms. She sat down. She was afraid they were going to tell her that the person who had been sent away, who she had identified, was getting on parole. So she was braced for that news. And what they told her instead was that there wasn't even a 1 in 6.5 billion chance that the rapist was anyone other than this other man who she didn't know, named Leon Davis Jr., and that she had made this mistake. And then, leaving her reeling, they said, "Don't worry about this too much, because neither of these guys, Leon Davis or the person who was falsely convicted, Thomas Hainsworth, are particularly good guys. So you should just move on with your life," which is, needless to say, first of all, not true at all in the case of Thomas Hainsworth, and second of all, not helpful advice to give to a victim. And they never engaged with her again. And Janet is now someone who does a tremendous amount to educate law enforcement about what she calls the trauma-informed approach to informing victims like her in situations like hers.
So Janet Burke and Thomas Hainsworth met. Who initiated that contact?
The person who initiated it was Thomas's attorney, this amazing woman named Sean Armbrust. And Sean had reached out to Janet while she was trying to get Thomas out of prison, because complicating Thomas's case was that Janet was not the only person he had been convicted of raping. We spoke earlier about the destruction of evidence. In those other two cases, the evidence had been destroyed, and so he couldn't be exonerated by DNA. Sean had to go through a very arduous process to get him out. And she wanted to see if Janet was willing to be an ally in that. And so she reached out to her, fearful that Janet would react in a pretty negative or hostile way. But in fact, Janet was so desperate for information that she and Sean were able to form this relationship, where Sean educated Janet about how false identifications occur, mistaken identifications occur, and really, I think, went some distance toward educating Janet and also making Janet feel less horrible. And then Sean, several years later, after kind of keeping an eye on Janet and obviously on Thomas, and seeing how they were recovering and reintegrating into the world with this new information, asked if they would be willing to sit down with each other. And so she was the one who brokered that meeting.
So what happened when they sat down in the same room together?
It was very emotional. Janet went into it extremely fearful. I think she had thought that Thomas hated her. And actually, she tells this story that after she told her family the story that one, she was a rape victim, and two, she had made a mistake in identification, and three, the person she had mistakenly identified was getting out, her son responded by going out and buying a gun because he was worried that Thomas was going to come after them and try to hurt his mother. I don't think Janet believed that several years down the road, but I think she feared Thomas's hatred and his condemnation of her. And so she went into it feeling extremely nervous. And then once she was actually in the room with him, she completely broke down. I just think that the experience of seeing him face to face shook her and kind of broke her. And she was just crying and asking for forgiveness. And Thomas's reaction was to take in what she was saying and then to tell her in this really sort of calm and loving way that he had forgiven her a long time ago and had come to understand that she had been doubly victimized, first by the attack and then by following in good faith a series of police procedures that just led to the wrong outcome. And I think his ability to forgive, but also to talk to her about what his experience had been like and how he had used his time in prison to become mentally and physically strong and had been determined to survive and had survived, gave her some solace.
My guest is Laura Bazelon. She's associate professor and director of the Criminal Juvenile Justice and Racial Justice Clinics at the University of San Francisco School of Law. Her book is called Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. Or, of course, you can send an email to think@kera.org. So the thing about prison, Laura, is that sometimes, I mean, there's the time you spend away, and then there's the psychic and even health damage that can occur from spending years incarcerated. And that's been the case for a lot of people who were wrongfully convicted.
Yes. So one recent and horrifying example is a man named Glenn Ford, who was convicted of a robbery and a murder in Louisiana and sent away to death row. And he spent, I can't remember, something like close to three decades in this tiny dark cell. And by the time he was exonerated, he had developed a fatal cancer that had spread to his bones. And within 18 months, he had died. There are other examples of exonerees who had medical conditions that went undetected or were poorly treated because of the healthcare system and the way it is in prison. And so they emerge very sick physically. And then, of course, as you indicate, there is also the psychological damage that people have coming out of prison, the PTSD, the difficulty reintegrating into civilian life, and just lasting impacts even for people who seem perfectly well adjusted.
Do they still face stigma, even if it's been proven that people were wrongfully convicted?
I think it depends on the person, but some exonerees will tell you that they do and that they live in fear that they won't be believed. So, for example, a lot of exonerees will carry around their paperwork that shows that their conviction was overturned in case they're stopped by the police and the police run their record and see that they were arrested and convicted of a very, very serious crime, so that they have these papers to prove instantly that they aren't this terrible person who needs to go directly back to prison, even though, of course, looking up their rap sheet would presumably show that they had been exonerated. But they feel the stigma and they feel the need to prove over and over again their innocence.
So there are how many states that provide no additional resources, no money, no classes, nothing for people who are exonerated?
Roughly 20. And it's really disgraceful. It's all over the map in terms of what you're entitled to. You and I talked earlier about Texas, which is relatively generous and gives $80,000 a year to people who've been wrongfully convicted. But there are states like my home state of Pennsylvania that don't give you a dime. And then there are other states that give flat amounts, you know, $25,000 after you've done 20 years. And then there are also states like my adopted state of California, where they have a wrongful compensation statute, but qualifying for it can be very arduous.
What do you have to do to qualify for it?
You essentially have to prove your innocence all over again, or In the case, for example, in Louisiana of Glenn Ford that we were just speaking of, he had applied for compensation and the judge denied it, finding that he had inadvertently contributed in some way to his own wrongful conviction. Some statutes force you to prove that you did nothing vertently or inadvertently to contribute to what happened to you.
You know, we're supposed to prefer the idea of 10 guilty people walking away rather than one innocent person being locked up. But a lot of people, if you press them, feel the opposite. Can you talk about why that's a problem?
People really fear crime. People also have this idea of who a criminal is. And for middle class people, it's often someone that they think they would never come across in their actual civilized life. And unfortunately, we have this concept of who criminals are, and many people think about their lives as being disposable. And so they're comfortable with the idea that they're being shunted off to prison at alarmingly high rates if it means that their communities are more safe. It's harder to engage with the idea that this is a true significant problem and that these are people that they're supposed to care about.
So we tell ourselves it's fine because this will never happen to me.
Yes, and these people are just such awful people that I just don't even need to concern myself with them. Or, you know, that throwaway line that the detectives gave to Janet Burke about Thomas Haynesworth. Well, don't worry about his having served 26 years because he wasn't a good guy anyway, which, as I said, wasn't true and is just so wrongheaded when you think about how the system is supposed to work.
We're speaking this hour with Laura Bazelon of the University of San Francisco School of Law. Her new book is called Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. If you'd like to join us, you can find us on Twitter at KERA Think. You can email think@kera.org, or you can give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Laura Bazelon, who is Associate Professor and Director of the Criminal Juvenile Justice and Racial Justice Clinics at the University of San Francisco School of Law. Her book is called Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. I can imagine there are people, Laura, who have been exonerated that regardless of not wanting to harm anyone, want nothing to do with their initial accuser. Do these restorative justice programs that seek to serve both original victims and victims of wrongful conviction require cooperation on all sides?
Yes, they do. And in fact, it can't work unless both people go into it with an open mind and an open heart. And you are right that there are some people who have been falsely convicted who want nothing to do with it. And there are some victims, original crime victims, who also want nothing to do with it. So while it is very meaningful and positive and emotionally sustaining for many people, it's not for everyone.
So some of these have been structured as weekend or several day retreats. Can you talk about what takes place in those sessions?
Sure. So the leading practitioner of this model of restorative justice is a woman named Jennifer Thompson, who may be familiar to some of your listeners. She wrote a best-selling book called Picking Cotton about her own violent rape and her mistaken identification of a man named Ronald Cotton and their very emotional reunion when he was released because of DNA evidence some years later. And what Jennifer realized is that what she and Ronald had been doing, the nature of their relationship, their very close bond, and also their activism, their joint activism to change laws, to change policies, and to educate the public, was their own form of restorative justice. They just didn't realize it at the time. And so what Jennifer learned after Picking Cotton took off was that so many people had her story, which she had thought of as sort of an aberrational one, but wasn't. And so she created an organization called Healing Justice. And this organization brings together original crime victims, exonerees, and also their friends and family members to do a three-day retreat in a very quiet rural part of North Carolina. And they stay together in this lodge. They eat meals together. They spend most of the day in a circle, a restorative justice circle, where they do a number of exercises that are designed to get to the root of the trauma and to allow everyone in the room to tell their story, but also listen to the stories of other people and to make these connections and to really dig down into the hurt and the trauma in a way that most people haven't because they haven't had the space or the safe feeling to do that.
So what's different after those retreats?
Well, my favorite example of something that can be different, and I talked about this case earlier in the interview, is between Thomas Hainsworth and the victim in his case. They went to a restorative justice retreat together a couple of years ago, and it was very, very hard for the victim to be in the room during the circle exercises, and she found them painful to the point of being overwhelming. She, when it was her turn to talk, would pass the talking piece, which is what you hold when you're talking and everyone has to listen to you, because she felt like she couldn't even speak. And when she listened to Thomas talk about what he had gone through and also how he had felt abandoned by his family and how he really had difficulty forming personal relationships, she felt this overwhelming sense of shame and guilt as if it was all her fault. And then that evening, they did an activity that was meant to be just kind of a casual activity where they made s'mores and they sat around a fire and sang songs. And she went up to Thomas to say to him how horrible she felt and how sorry she was and how she could never get over what she had done to him. And he turned to her almost in anger and said, well, you have to forgive yourself and you have to move past these feelings that you have because they're holding me back from my own recovery and my own life. And as long as you carry this around, this guilt and shame, you're imprisoning me too. So for me to move forward, you have to move forward. And it was really this breakthrough moment in their relationship and also, I think, in this woman's healing process.
What about the professionals in the criminal justice system who, as you said earlier, inadvertently or inadvertently caused wrongful convictions to happen?
It really depends. There are people in the system who are shaken up and do the right thing. And I talk about some of those folks in the book, and they are somewhat unlikely heroes. The person who was responsible for Thomas Hainsworth's exoneration in Virginia, more than anyone, was the attorney general at the time, whose name is Ken Cuccinelli II. And he is a very, very conservative person who was elected on a law and order platform and someone you might think would be not sympathetic to a claim of wrongful conviction where there was one case where there was DNA, but several cases where there was no DNA and the victims were not recanting their identification. But Ken Cuccinelli took a hard look at these cases and he decided to advocate on the side of Thomas Hainsworth. And he went to the Court of Appeals in Virginia in front of the full court, 9 justices, and said that the state had made a mistake and that he was siding with the defendant. So even though the title of the case was Commonwealth versus Hainsworth, Ken Cuccinelli had moved over from the versus, to stand with the wrongfully accused person. And there are examples of that happening, which I think we need to hold up and really praise and celebrate, because that's an example of someone in law enforcement embracing their role as a minister of justice. And there are also detectives, like the detective in Jennifer Thompson's case, Mike Golden, who decided that he was going to be on the forefront of a reform movement. And in North Carolina, because of Jennifer Thompson and Ronald Cotton's advocacy, and because of people like Mike Golden, they now have best practices for the way that victims are instructed to make identifications by police.
So the elevation of DNA science has been really a godsend for a number of people who have been exonerated after years incarcerated under wrongful convictions. On the other hand, that's what we expect now, right? If someone is to be exonerated, surely there are people who were wrongfully convicted but don't have DNA evidence that might help to demonstrate that.
That's true. So the project where I worked, which is called the Loyola Law School Project for the Innocent in Los Angeles, which was a small project, still there, very good project, we took only non-DNA cases. So Cash's case, for example, is a case where there was no DNA evidence. In fact, they had destroyed all the physical evidence. And so it was a question of re-examining it from the ground up and proving that every single element of the state's case was essentially based on nothing and dismembering it part by part. And it's very hard to do.
So how should this affect us the next time we sit in a jury box, this information?
When I talk about this book, I like to stress to folks who think, what can I do? I'm not a lawyer. I don't have anything to do with the legal process, but I'm concerned about this issue. What I say is, do your job as a juror. Take it seriously. and stick to your convictions. One of the chilling conversations that I had after Cash was released was with one of his jurors who emailed me because the case had gotten quite a bit of media attention in part because of Cash's really unusual name. And the juror wrote to me to say how fundamentally disillusioned and horrified he was to learn that he had voted to convict Cash. And then when I met with him one-on-one, he described what happened in the jury room. And essentially, he and this one other person were holding out for not guilty because they didn't feel convinced by the evidence, because there wasn't a lot of evidence. He was very young, though. He was 18. The other person crossed over, and so it was just him against 11 people telling him that he was inexperienced, that he didn't understand, and also really pressuring him to vote to convict, essentially so that they could all go home. And so he caved in and convicted, even though he wasn't, you know, convinced beyond a reasonable doubt, and it haunted him. And then to find out that he was wrong devastated him. And so what I would say to people is, if you have doubt, if you have reasonable doubt, even though it's so hard in that room and it's so coercive and you're the only one, stand by your convictions.
Yeah, there's so much evidence now about the effect of social pressure on every kind of behavior, right? On whether we walk through the left door or the right door entering a building. If everybody does it a certain way, we tend to follow because we're social creatures. And it does seem like this isn't often taken into account in the way that even questions about mistaken identifications are starting to be acknowledged.
It's true. There's a tremendous pressure to conform, and there's nothing harder than being the only person in a closed-off room who has an opinion that is different from 11 other opinions, or say it's 10 to 2. You know, you have one other person there as your ally. It's very hard to stick by that in the face of this pressure of everyone else telling you that you're wrong. And you're right, it does conform to how we behave as humans. We, to some degree, are like lemmings. We follow the crowd. We want to be liked. All of those things play a role in jury deliberations.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. How do you decide what cases that you want to take up when it appears that someone may be incarcerated on a wrongful conviction?
It's really hard, and a lot of the work that we did at Loyola was screening. So many people will write to you and say that they're innocent when they are in fact not. And so part of the process of many innocence projects is weeding out those claims and getting to the true claims. And sometimes that requires a certain level of investigation to realize, okay, this isn't a good case for us to take because either we can't prove it or it really does seem as if the person is in fact guilty. So it's hard to tell often on the face of something whether it's a meritorious claim, and usually you have to do some digging.
Is there any evidence that people who've been wrongfully convicted ever sort of get gaslighted into thinking that they might have had something to do with this crime?
Yes. The New Yorker just published a piece within the past year about a group of people who all, I think four or five of them, were absolutely convinced that they were guilty, even after the evidence showed that they were innocent.
Wow.
It's amazing. And it goes back to sort of what happens to people in the interrogation room, the information that they're fed, the things that they're told, and the things that they start to believe about themselves, even when they're demonstrably untrue.
So lots of people listening may have very little experience with the criminal justice system, and imagine it would be frightening to sit across a table from someone who's been incarcerated. What do you discover about at least some of these individuals as you just get to know them as people?
I found this to be true about all my clients, including when I was a federal public defender. It's not what you expect. You're not sitting across from someone who is scary or going to jump at you across the table. You're sitting across the table from a human being. And what you find is that you have various degrees of commonality, whether it's that you each have the same number of siblings or you each have family from a geographic region. There are areas of commonality and connection. With people who've been wrongfully convicted, what I found is that often they're very guarded and stoic because they're used to be being disbelieved. And so they're almost nervous to think that someone is actually taking them seriously, and it can take a long time to develop a rapport with them. But certainly this concept that sitting down in a room with someone who's been accused or been convicted is somehow going to expose you to a public safety risk is not true.
Is it even possible to generalize what the experience is like for people who've been exonerated after years behind bars, trying to rebuild relationships with friends and family?
It's hard to generalize, and I think it really depends on the person. One thing I will say is that I do think that to some degree, certain habits never leave you. So for example, I think for people who've been incarcerated for decades, they will abide by a very strict routine because that's how they got through prison, was waking up at a certain time and then having their day be very carefully and rigidly constructed around mealtimes, exercise, whether they were writing or reading the Bible or painting. And so when they get out, it's very hard for them to think that they have flexibility in their schedule. And they will often wake up and eat and exercise and go to bed on the same schedule.
Do you meet a lot of resistance when you run into someone who is a prosecutor? Are they resentful of this work?
Again, I think it depends. I actually was fortunate enough recently to just be able to give a talk to a group of newly elected prosecutors in Houston, many people who ran on reform platforms, including the idea that they were going to either start or shore up existing units to examine wrongful convictions. And it was so affirming to be in the room with these folks because not only were they diverse in terms of race and ethnicity and age and geography, but they had this viewpoint that they really saw their job as reform-minded and doing justice in a way that meant that they were going to look into these cases and that they were not going to be afraid of admitting to mistakes and that they were not going to shy away from apologizing. So I do think that we have come to this point in reforming the system where we are more and more moving toward electing people like that, which I find very heartening.
Laura Bazelon is Associate Professor and Director of the Criminal Juvenile Justice and Racial Justice Clinics at the University of San Francisco School of Law. She's author of the book Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. Laura, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at KERA Think. You can use your favorite podcasting app to become a subscriber to the Think podcast, or you can go straight to our website and listen to it from there. That's at think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.